Please join me in welcoming Dr. Delgado.
Thank you very much for that nice introduction. And it's certainly wonderful to be here to join all of you on this March for Life weekend. I think probably all of you attended the March for Life. Is that safe to assume? Okay, fantastic. Well, when I was there, I think the best sign I saw, I was looking around at all the signs, and it was just hand-scrawled. It wasn't a really fancy sign. But it said, "The body inside your body is not your body." And doesn't that just sum it up for us right there? It's very charitable, but it's the truth. And I think that's what we have to do in our fight to defend life. And that was a very beautiful matins service that I was very privileged to join you in. Wonderful music and a great sermon. That reading from Genesis, though, really sets the tone that we are created in the image and likeness of God. So like the Marines, we should have the motto that no person should be left behind. And so that's why we're here, because we're interested in the saving, the spiritual lives of all the mothers who are in crisis pregnancies. But we're also interested in saving the lives of all the babies who are threatened by abortion or who have started the abortion process. And that's what we're going to discuss today. So we're going to talk about the reversal of mifepristone with progesterone. So I want to leave you with these points: that abortion pill reversal is safe and it's effective, and that women who are given the opportunity to reverse the effects of the abortion pill are very grateful indeed. Let's talk about a little bit about mifepristone. There's some confusion on how to pronounce it, on what it is, what it means. So I'm going to go through that because it's a little confusing. Because any medication on the market really will have at least three or four names, usually four names. The first is the chemical name that nobody ever knows, that if you look in the chemical books, it's a really long name, 5-4-diethyl methoxy something. Nobody ever remembers those except for the basic scientists. Then it has a developmental name. And that's because there's probably only about 10% of all medications actually ever reach the market. And so these companies aren't going to spend a lot of time marketing, coming up with a clever name for a medication that won't ever leave the make it to the marketplace. So they have a developmental name. And for this one, it was RU486. And the RU stands for Roussel-Ouklaf, which was the pharmaceutical giant in Europe that developed this medication. And it was called 486 because it was, in that series of drugs, it was the 486 that they had developed. Well, once it got moving along the pipeline and it was approved, then it was given the generic name mifepristone. And then each drug, of course, has a generic name, but it also has a brand name that's patented, and that was Mifeprex is the name you'll also hear. So most young people will know about mifepristone. Most people in my generation who remembered back in the 70s when we were fighting this to try to keep this off the market will know the name RU486, but they both apply to it. When you go to Planned Parenthood's website, though, they'll talk about pill abortion or even on billboards. I was just talking to some folks out front here where they saw a sign that said Carafem. That's a chain of abortion clinics. They put Carafem pill abortion. They almost thought that Carafem was the brand name for the mifepristone. Sometimes it'll be called medical abortion. In our articles, we call it medical-induced abortion, and that's in contradistinction to surgical-induced abortion. So surgical abortion is sort of the older way to do it. This is the new way, medical abortion, that kills the baby with a medication. You might also see the name Korlym, because this medication, mifepristone, not only can it cause abortions, and it's used to cause abortions, but it also can treat some medical conditions having to do with the endocrine system, something called Cushing syndrome. But in order to not confuse people, they branded it differently, Korlym, and it comes in a 300-milligram pill instead of a 200-milligram pill. So what is the abortion pill, and what is the morning-after pill? Because I see a lot of confusion between those two there. Have any of you ever wondered what's the difference between those two? Some of you have. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about the morning after pill. Our talk today will not be about the morning after pill, but I just want to straighten out any confusion here. It's designed to be taken usually within 72 hours of a woman having intercourse. That's with the exception of Ella, which I won't go into today. And it's designed to, quote, prevent pregnancy. I put it in quotation marks because actually these morning after pills are probably abortifacient much of the time. There's some new articles that have come out, many of them in the Lineker Journal that have demonstrated that. But they are at least designed to be preventing pregnancy. But we do have to keep that in mind. They probably are abortifacient. Now, mifepristone, the abortion pill, is totally different. It's taken once a woman knows she's pregnant, and it's approved up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. So a big difference, not taken within 72 hours after intercourse, but up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. And it's a deliberate attempt to abort a known pregnancy. No bones about it. This is an abortion. This is a medical abortion. And that's why it's called the abortion pill and not called the morning after pill. Now I want to talk a little bit about our APR team. Dr. Matthew Harrison is our associate medical director. Dr. Mary Davenport, who's been a big voice in pro-life medicine for many years, is our director of research. We also are very proud and very pleased to have the support of the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs. Donna Harrison, our executive director, is back here in the back, and she's, as you all know, has been a tireless voice for the unborn and has really contributed a great deal to our scientific understanding and explanations of why pro-life matters. And I'm also very privileged to be a member of their board and have just been very pleased to serve with her. Dr. Harrison, our associate medical director, actually accomplished the very first reversal of mifepristone back in 2006-2007 when a woman came to him in his clinic and said, "Doctor, I've taken mifepristone, the abortion pill, and I've changed my mind. Can you help me? Can you reverse this process?" Well, Dr. Harrison had never heard of this before and wasn't really sure what to do, so he stepped out of his exam room and started to pray. And the Lord gave him guidance. He had used progesterone in the past in order to prevent miscarriage, and so he knew how to use progesterone. And he theorized, well, I know that mifepristone blocks the effects of progesterone, so maybe if I give more progesterone, then perhaps I can reverse this process. So Dr. Harrison set out in uncharted waters and gave her progesterone, and he was able to save the baby's life. And that was our very first reversal. 2 years later, I had not heard of Dr. Harrison's case, so I was also very ignorant of this, but I had known a lot about mifepristone because when it was approved, I had studied it and seen how it works and that it was a progesterone blocker. And in my training in NAPRO technology, I'd also learned how to use progesterone. I'd used progesterone, like Dr. Harrison, a great deal to prevent miscarriages and to treat women with low progesterone levels. Well, I got a call from this sidewalk counselor, Terry Palmquist, who is in Bakersfield, California. She has a 1-800 number. She answers her cell phone when she's counseling out in front of abortion centers. She got a call from this woman in El Paso, Texas, who said, "I've taken mifepristone, the abortion pill, and I changed my mind. Can you help me reverse it?" So Terry had no idea what to do, so she called me because I had often given her a lot of help with pro-life questions. And she asked me, "Do you have any idea?" I said, "Well, I've never heard of this before." But I said, "Let me think about it." So I prayed and thought about it. And I thought, just like Dr. Harrison, that maybe if I give extra progesterone that we can help reverse the effects of the mifepristone. But I was in San Diego. She was in El Paso. So I got on the phone. I found a NAPRO technology doctor, Dr. Jonathan Benakura in El Paso, Texas, who happened to have progesterone in the office because she used it a lot. And I said, "Dr. Benakura, can you help this woman?" She said, "Sure, what do I do?" I said, "Well, this is what I think we ought to do." So on the fly, I devised a protocol and told her what I thought she ought to give the woman. And she did. And the result is this little girl right here. So that was the second one. So now let me tell you a little bit more about how mifepristone works so you can understand it a little bit. So mifepristone is a progesterone receptor blocker. It blocks the effects of progesterone. That's very important to keep in mind. And progesterone is an essential hormone for pregnancy. That's why it's called progesterone, progestation. And if you think about how these receptors and these hormones work, I'm going to simplify it for you a little bit, but think about a key that goes into a lock and unlocks the lock, and the door opens. Well, that door opening is what we call the hormone effect. It's what we want to happen in the body. And without the hormone turning that lock, the hormone effect does not occur. Now, think about the times whenever you've had put the wrong key into a lock. It slipped into the lock, but the lock doesn't turn, right? So it's a false key. That's exactly what the receptor blocker is. That's what mifepristone is. It's a false key that enters the lock but does not turn the lock. So then you don't open the door and you don't have the hormone effect. without the hormone effect, without the progesterone effect, then the baby dies. So that's how it works. Fortunately, the key doesn't stay in the lock forever, though. The key comes in and out of the lock. So while the key is out of the lock, that's an opportunity for the true key, the progesterone, to get in there to turn the lock and to open the door. So you can see there can be a competition going on there at the lock. And so if we give extra progesterone, we have more of the good guy keys lined up, ready to go into that lock. They can outcompete the false keys until the false keys wash out of the system. That's pretty much how it works, how we reverse the effects of the mifepristone. This is just a little schematic showing, for those of you who know a little bit about biochemistry, how the progesterone gets on here, causes things to go in the right direction, while a blocker goes here and puts a lock on the whole system. So now that you know how mifepristone and progesterone compete, let me tell you a little bit about what progesterone does, all the good things. The good things that happen in a normal pregnancy, the things that are stopped when you give mifepristone or RU486. So the first thing that progesterone does is it prepares the lining of the uterus in order to be very thick and luxuriant and to be hospitable so that the embryo can implant in there and have a good place to implant and survive. It also promotes the development of part of the placenta called the decidua basalis. The vast majority of the placenta comes from the embryo, but there's a very thin layer that comes from the mother, and that part is very important, and that part depends on progesterone. It also keeps the uterine muscle quiet because you don't want contractions during the pregnancy. You want contractions at the end of the pregnancy. So God has made a perfect design. He has progesterone levels high during the pregnancy to keep the muscle nice and relaxed. But what happens when labor starts, or right before labor starts? Progesterone levels plummet, and then the uterus can start contracting. So it keeps it from contracting during the pregnancy. The progesterone also promotes the development of the milk-producing cells in the breast. But at the same time, it inhibits milk production. So it gets everything ready right on the starting line for milk production, but doesn't allow milk production until, again, the progesterone levels fall, and then you start having milk production. And it keeps the cervix closed. The cervix is the opening of the uterus. It's known as a biological valve. During pregnancy, you want the outside world entirely out of the uterus, so it's closed tight to keep the outside world out. Again, when progesterone levels fall at the end of the pregnancy, the cervix starts to open, and that's what you want. You want a wide open cervix so that the baby can be delivered. This is a little diagram. Just wanted to show here where the placenta attaches. I told you that part, the decidua basalis that comes from the mother, is dependent on the progesterone. So when progesterone levels fall, you get a separation here. So the placenta separates from the wall of the uterus. The baby can no longer get nutrition through the blood flow mixing, the transfer of nutrients from one blood supply to the other, and so the embryo or the fetus dies. So that's what causes the death of the embryo or the fetus by the mifepristone, is the separation of the placenta. And, of course, you get the other effects with the muscle of the uterus. Mifepristone, as you know, also known as RU486, has been available, approved in the U.S. since 2000. These days, 30 to 45% of all abortions are no longer surgical abortions. They're now medical abortions with mifepristone. That number is going up. At Planned Parenthood's, a Reuters report late last year said that about 43% of all of their abortions at Planned Parenthood are mifepristone abortions. So this is becoming a bigger and a bigger issue. In some countries in Europe, 80% of their abortions are mifepristone abortions, no longer surgical abortions. And this is what was proclaimed as the holy grail for the abortion activists, because they want to take abortion out of the clinic and in the privacy of the mother's home. And this is a step towards that. They just take that medication in the clinic. The rest of it happens at home. They pass the remains of the baby at home. And so this is something they've been fighting for a long, long time. Of course, when God always presents a challenge, he usually gives us an advantage. And so the challenge here is that there are fewer obstacles to abortion because it's no longer surgical. But the benefit for us is that compared to a surgical abortion, once the procedure starts, it's over. The baby's life has ended. But with this, now we have a window of opportunity to reverse the abortion. So we see that this is actually a great advantage for all of us who are striving to work hard to save the spiritual lives of the mothers and save the physical lives of the unborn babies. So how is mifepristone RU46 given? It's given, like I said, 200 milligrams by mouth in the office of the abortionist or in the abortion clinic. It's followed 24 to 48 hours by a second drug called misoprostol to completely empty the uterus. Why do they give the second drug? We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But mifepristone is very effective at killing the embryo or the fetus, but it doesn't always lead to the contractions of the uterus to empty out the contents, to empty the remains of the baby out. So that's why they give the second drug, misoprostol, which is a very potent agent that causes the uterus to contract. And it contracts very strongly to push out the remains. The new FDA approval is that this medication combination is approved up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. 10 weeks of pregnancy. It's probably going to be pushed beyond that, so don't be surprised if you see women being given this beyond that. What about survival if the woman only takes the mifepristone and does nothing at all? Our studies show, and this, a lot of this work is done by Dr. Mary Davenport, who's right now completing a review article of the old mifepristone literature, and it shows that if you only take mifepristone, the first drug, about 15% of the embryos or fetuses, the unborn babies, will survive if you do nothing at all. But remember, I told you that the mifepristone is not great at emptying the uterus. 20 to 40% of the time, the uterus will not be completely emptied. Now, it's important to remember that the pro-abortionists will manipulate these facts. They'll say that 40% or 50% will survive the mifepristone, but there's a clear difference between surviving, the embryo being still alive, and the embryo being dead, but still the body inside the uterus. So it's a very important distinction to be made there. In the FDA trials that approved it, the incomplete abortion rate was about 5% and 7%. This is taking both drugs, not just the one drug. And the rates of survival if you take both drugs go from 15% to 9%. I told you about the mifepristone only, 60 to 80% completed abortion rate. Embryo survival is about 15%. I told you about Korlym, that other brand name in case it's used for medical issues. And a little bit about how it gets inside of you. About 70% of it is absorbed. It binds to the progesterone receptor about twice as well as progesterone. So if we go back to our key analogy, the mifepristone, the false key, stays in the lock, let's say 2 seconds, while the progesterone stays in the lock 1 second. So we're at a little bit of a competitive disadvantage there. So we think about that when we how we devised our dosing. The half-life of the drug is about 18 to 25 hours compared to 25 to 55 hours for progesterone. So they stay in the bloodstream about the same time. This was the case series report that Dr. Davenport and I published in Annals of Pharmacology at the end of 2012. This was, like was mentioned, the very first article. This was the case series article, and this shows the 6 patients on which we reported. The age of the babies were anywhere from 7 to 11 weeks gestation. The time they got the progesterone was anywhere from 7 to 72 hours after getting the mifepristone. And most of them got injected progesterone. And 4 out of 6 had healthy births, and 2 of them completed their abortions. So 4 out of 6 survived. Once we looked at this, we got very excited, and that's when I started the Abortion Pill Reversal Network, because I knew that we had 2 big challenges. One is that women were having difficulty finding us, and we needed to have a great outreach, and so we started our website, abortionpillreversal.com, and our 24-hour, 7-day-a-week hotline. And we also started recruiting doctors to join our network so that we could have doctors close to where they were, so we wouldn't get into the situation again where a patient was in El Paso and I was in San Diego. And from there, it started to grow to where we are right now. Since May 2012 to 2016, we've had more than 1,800 calls to our hotline. We're probably close to 2,000 now. About 250 babies have been born, and another 100 women are pregnant. Our success rate with our best protocols is now 65 to 70%, and our birth defect rate is about equal to the general population, about 3%. The preterm birth rate, the babies born before 37 weeks, the premature babies, is actually less than the general population, so we're very pleased with that. In our preliminary analysis, and I'm currently preparing another paper that I'll be submitting for publication hopefully in the next 2 to 3 weeks, the progesterone intramuscular injection, the shots, and the high-dose oral regimens seem to be the best ones. And again, those are success rates of 65 to 70% of reversing the mifepristone and babies surviving. Thus far, we've helped women in more than 45 states and in 13 foreign countries. We do have some challenges and barriers that I want to talk about. The first is regarding birth defects. And also want to tell you about where we've been growing. Australia has developed its own network, Australian Mifepristone Reversal. They have their own hotline, a whole regional network there. We've been in discussions with people in Latin America, especially in Mexico, to start what we would call PRA, a network based there so that they don't have to call us, have a language barrier and cultural differences. And we've had people in Europe who are interested. There were just today at the March for Life, there were some people from Switzerland trying to get a hold of me. They want to start their own network there in Europe. So let's look now at birth defects. Everybody's paranoid about birth defects. Everybody's worried about birth defects. It's really amazing how these women, and I've seen them in my own clinic, come in and they've tried to abort their babies. Then they've changed their mind, and now they want me to do whatever I can to save their babies. But first they want to know, well, is what you're going to give me, could it cause birth defects? So it's really a very interesting dynamic of their concerns. But everybody is concerned about birth defects. When we look at the data on birth defects, of course, we want to look at mifepristone RU46 alone and look at misoprostol, the second drug. And when you look at misoprostol, it definitely does cause birth defects. It causes problems with short arms and legs and facial paralysis. When you look at mifepristone, we have no good evidence that it causes birth defects. And when you look at both, the birth defects are the same as misoprostol. So we can conclude then that mifepristone is not associated with birth defects. So if they take just the first medication, it's not. If they happen to take the second medication, they do have about a 4 to 12% chance of these birth defects. So definitely there, but not a huge risk of birth defects. And this is very interesting because many of the women, when they've called Planned Parenthood or other abortion centers where they've gotten the mifepristone and they tell them they want to reverse, one of the things that they say to them is, your baby's sure to have birth defects. And no, what they really should say is, your baby is sure not to have birth defects if they've only taken mifepristone. Very important textbook called Drugs in Pregnancy and Lactation reassures us that there are no studies showing birth defects in mifepristone. The American College of OBGYNs, which is no great fan of our work nor of APLOG, they actually came out with a practice bulletin in 2014 there's in general about medical abortion, and they mentioned in there that there's no evidence that mifepristone causes birth defects. So we can trust that they're not lying on this one. Some other studies showing mifepristone's safety. There are not many studies in the literature, but the ones that are there do show. But probably the biggest series now will be our article that's coming out when you look at all the literature. And of more than 300 successful mifepristone reversals, like I said, the birth defect rate is about equal to the general population. So this should very much reassure people. There has been some concern with progestins causing birth defects, especially of the male penis. And but these are artificial progestins. When you look at a group headed by Dr. Thomas Hilgers at the Pope Paul VI Institute in Omaha, Nebraska, the originator of NAPRO technology, there they had a series of over 500 babies, and the risk of hypospadias was actually less than the women who got progesterone. So that tells us that the progesterone, the natural progesterone that we advocate, is safe. In 1999, the FDA reviewed progesterone and said that there was not associated with birth defects. So the progesterone, we think, is very safe. The American Society of Reproductive Medicine, these are the IVF doctors. Their main interest, of course, is in having successful IVF cycles and having successful births. So they don't really care about abortion pill reversal. And their statement, they feel that it's unlikely that progesterone causes any birth defects. So progesterone has about a 40-year history of great safety. Now, there has been one recent Danish study looking at women with infertility, and they found an increased risk of leukemia and some nerve tumors in mothers who had taken progesterone during pregnancy and before pregnancy. The greatest risk was for women who had taken progesterone for multiple cycles before that pregnancy. Now, it's important to remember this is just a population study, and that there's a much different group in the women who are seeking mifepristone reversal compared to women who are infertile. These women are taking progesterone usually cycle after cycle. The mifepristone women just take the progesterone to reverse the effects of the mifepristone for a short time. And also, it's important to remember that the authors of this study felt that because of the small numbers of the tumors and the leukemias, that this needs further study. Sometimes we have the challenge of finding a doctor for the woman, because sometimes we just don't have doctors available in some areas, and we have to scramble around, and time is of the essence. Sometimes the doctors who are in our network don't have progesterone in the office or haven't thought far enough ahead to be ready for it. Other challenges are opposition from the mainstream media and the mainstream medical establishment. They contradict themselves by saying that reversal is unlikely and that mifepristone is ineffective, and they exaggerate the mifepristone failure rate. They call our science junk science. They state that there's no proof, even though we've had more than 200 births now and another 100 women are pregnant after greater than 300 successful reversals. And they're hypocritical. They attack off-label use of progesterone, which I'll discuss in a second. And they also are quite arrogant in dismissing the possibility the woman actually might change her mind. So let's look at the mifepristone failure again. Mifepristone leads to incomplete abortion 20 to 40% of the time. Incomplete abortion, like I said, means that the uterus is not empty. It does not imply that the baby has survived. In the early studies, the continuation of pregnancy rates, the embryo survival was about 15%. Many of these women who survived where the baby survived to a certain point, however, had surgical abortions, so we actually don't know which of those would have really survived longer or would have died after just giving them a little more time. So because of that, the survival rate might actually have been lower. And the attack that this is junk science and not new science, well, I tell them, well, first of all, let's look at the mechanism of action of how mifepristone and progesterone use work. It's biologically logical that giving more progesterone is going to outcompete the mifepristone. That makes perfect sense. In Japan, they did a basic study with rats where they gave one group of rats progesterone and mifepristone. The other group of rats only got mifepristone. And they saw that the group that got mifepristone with the progesterone, all of the effects of the mifepristone were blocked. So proving there in the rats that the mifepristone's effects were blocked by progesterone. And then, of course, you have our case series, which I've discussed already, showing that our success rate, our embryo survival rate, goes from 15% as high as 70% with our best protocols. So to me, that's very good evidence that what we're doing makes a difference. Off-label or off-base, they criticize us for using progesterone in an off-label fashion. Off-label simply means that you use an approved medication for something other than for what it was approved. So many of you probably take heart medicines that were originally only approved for high blood pressure but can be used to protect the heart. That's done all the time in medicine. And in fact, mifepristone was used off-label for many years until it just got the approval of being used up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. So this is something that's commonly done and really shouldn't be criticized. And how about changing their minds? Now, some of their studies looking at women changing their minds show a very small percentage of women changing their minds. But the way they design their studies are biased to show or to not show that women do have regret. When you look at evidence by Dr. Coleman and other psychologists, they have done much better design studies that actually ask women longitudinally how they feel about their abortions. And we see a great deal of regret there. And so even if there were only 10% of women regretting their medical abortions, that would be 30,000 to 40,000 women a year in our country who would want to reverse their abortions potentially. So this is a huge number of women, and that should not be discounted. And I think, again, it's quite arrogant to assume that they would never change their minds. All of us change our minds when we make big decisions throughout our lives. And our opponents really pro-choice when they want to deny women a second choice. I think they're not. They're actually just pro-abortion. So my conclusions on this part of the talk are that mifepristone reversal using progesterone is safe and effective. Our growing case study shows that women can and do want to reverse the effects of it, and that the progesterone outcompetes the mifepristone at the receptor site. There's no scientific evidence suggesting that mifepristone causes birth defects. And progesterone and 17-hydroxyprogesterone, which is a related compound, are both safe in pregnancy. The protocols, like I've mentioned, the injection, the high-dose oral, and some are using high-dose vaginal protocol, where they take the progesterone vaginally. Thus far, our preliminary analysis, we're still looking deeper into that, so does not show as good of a success rate, so we'll have to wait until we publish our article to know more about that. For those of you interested in the doses, I'll go over this very quickly. With our high dose, we give 200 milligram capsules, two in the morning and two at night for 3 days, and then simply two at night every night until the end of the first trimester. For the intramuscular, it's an injection of 200 milligrams every day for 3 days, and then every other day until 2 weeks after they took the mifepristone, and then twice a week until the end of the first trimester. We do recommend getting an ultrasound as soon as possible, but we do not recommend delaying the start of progesterone to await the ultrasound. We want to get the progesterone on board as soon as possible. So our next goal after we finish this article is to have a randomized controlled trial, which is a trial where we will randomize women to get one or the other of the effective treatments, and then she will stay on that course hopefully throughout the trial. And so this is a much more effective way to scientifically prove things. What we've done so far has been what we've been able to do up to now, which is a case series observing women and observing what doctors have been giving them. So our next step is a randomized controlled trial, so we'll hopefully be embarking on that within the next year. And we think with the evidence we have right now, it would be unethical to have what we call a placebo group, a group receive nothing at all, because we feel that this is life and death, of course, and that we should offer effective treatments when we know that they are effective. Many doctors, after the first trimester, will start checking progesterone levels and may check progesterone or give progesterone if the progesterone levels are no. This is controversial, but many doctors find it very effective. So when we want to help these women, if all of you want to help in any way with your pregnancy resource centers, probably the most important thing is to be available, be there for them at any time. How do they find us? They go online to abortionpillreversal.com, and then they call our 24/7 hotline. This is our website. I encourage you to visit it, to get familiar with it. There's lots of very interesting and informative facts on there. We have more than 350 APR doctors at this point throughout the country. We still have big pockets, though, where we don't have doctors, so we want to fill those holes. We also, in the major metropolitan areas, don't have enough doctors, so New York and L.A. and South Florida, we definitely need more doctors. More doctors are becoming aware. This was a press conference that we gave at the National Press Club. You see Father Frank Pavone here. Here's Dr. Davenport, Dr. Matthew Harrison, our associate medical director, and these are some members of APLOG right here. So we want you to reach out if you know any doctors, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, midwives who would like to join. Please contact them, ask them to join our network. Our goal is to saturate the country with medical professionals and indeed then saturate the world. If you're affiliated with pregnancy medical clinics, we want pregnancy medical clinics to join us because they can be a hub in our network. With a medical director, they can provide needed counseling and support. They can keep progesterone in the office. The medical director can prescribe the progesterone. An RN can administer injections if they're using the injection protocol. And they can make follow-up calls and make sure that the patient is doing okay. This is a schematic where we get the call for the APR hotline. We get connected with the Pregnancy Resource Center in the area. The APR client becomes the patient here and interacts mostly with the Pregnancy Resource Center, goes to the doctor's office if needed, or everything can be done at the pregnancy medical clinic if it has a medical license. So this is a great way to keep it in the community. The resources we offer for the doctors and for the pregnancy medical clinics, our 24/7 hotline is always available. We have consent forms, legal documents that you can use, supported follow-up as needed. Our nurses can follow along with you. We have model standing orders so that you don't have to start from scratch. We have the protocol itself. We have the APR kit. And we have advice available from our APR nurses as well as from me if there are any medical questions or logistical issues that arise. This is our APR kit that we have. that comes with all the needed documents in there. It also has space in there to store progesterone so that in the office or in the pregnancy medical clinic, it can be on the shelf, ready to go so that people don't have to scramble around and wonder, where did we put that consent form or where did we put the progesterone? It's all in one place so that you're ready for action. It's truly an emergency kit. This was developed by Dr. Harrison, our associate medical director. We have a four-pronged approach for recruiting doctors and other medical professionals. We want to recruit OBGYNs, of course, primary care physicians like myself, PRCs, pregnancy resource centers, and emergency departments and emergency physicians. Because this truly is a medical emergency, so we really want it to be in emergency departments who are open 24 hours. So now I've given you a lot of numbers. Now I want to talk a little bit about the faces behind the numbers. So we go back to our old challenges and barriers list here. Sometimes there's ambivalence and mixed decisions or mixed feelings. Some have taken misoprostol, the second drug, even after they've started the progesterone protocol. So they go back and forth. So that's why the relationship with them is so important. And that's how all of you and your pro-life roles can be so important, because the relationships, any kind of conversion of heart always takes place in the context of a relationship, I'm sure you'll agree. So the relationships are very important to keep these women strong, to give them the support they need, because people are tugging at them in all directions. The influence of families can be positive or negative, and the discomfort of progesterone injections, if they're on the injection protocol, can be a barrier also. It can be difficult tracking these patients. Our hotline nurses set up relationships, and they're texting back and forth with these women to make sure they're doing okay. Well, they will abruptly, after having rapid-fire texts, as all of you know, sometimes our young people can do, all of a sudden the text messaging will stop, and they just, it's like they've fallen off the face of the earth, and we don't know what happened. But then we've had many cases where, just as abruptly, the texts start coming back. Hey, I'm 25 weeks pregnant. Everything's going great. Well, where were you all these weeks? We just don't know. But they do come back to us and start telling us how they're doing. But it can be a challenge when they're not answering our text messages or our phone calls. Lack of emotional support. Sometimes the families want them to abort. As you know, the typical scenario, the boyfriend threatens to leave if they don't abort, or sometimes it's the husband. But many, many times we've seen it's the mother or the grandmother who's really coercing them to abort. And many lack financial resources. There can be lack of bonding with the unborn baby. That's the reason why they choose abortion in the first place. They haven't bonded with that special person inside of them. And oftentimes when they go to the abortion center, they do an ultrasound. They will not show them the ultrasound screen. They do not see that baby. And when they've come to us in our clinic and I've done an ultrasound, they've often told me that, oh, they didn't show me that at the clinic. While we're trying to show them everything about this beautiful baby and this beating heartbeat, that's the first time they've seen it. The abortion clinic pressures are intense. They make them sign a paper that says that they will complete the medical abortion. And they coerce them. Numerous patients have been told when they've called later, hi, I want to reverse my abortion. Is there anything I can do? They've been told, you have to finish what you've started. There was another woman who went in just for a consultation, and she said, before I knew it, I had a glass of water in my hand, and I was taking a pill. Very quickly, they moved her through it. The birth defects have been exaggerated. Like I said before, your baby's sure to have birth defects. They either have not been reading the medical literature or they're just outright lying. And one particularly cruel comment, a woman called and said, I want to reverse my abortion. And the woman on the other line said, this would be like shooting your dog and watching it die slowly. This is the compassionate care that Planned Parenthood gives these women. This is Cynthia, who was our first San Diego case. And she was a San Diego State University student. She had this boyfriend named Jael, very nice couple. But unfortunately, they put things in the improper order, and they had sex before marriage. And what often happens is God's plan works its way out, and she conceived this child. Well, she immediately wanted to abort her baby because she thought that if she carried the pregnancy to term and she delivered a baby, that all of her educational dreams would be shattered. So she went to her mother and said, Mom, I want you to take me to have an abortion. And the mother kept trying to dissuade her over and over again, trying to talk her out of it. And the daughter persisted. And finally, unfortunately, the mother caved into her and took her to the abortion clinic where she was given mifepristone. Cynthia's mother immediately felt regret, and so she went for counsel to her parish priest, who said, "Oh, well, I know Dr. Delgado can reverse this." Thanks be to God that he was keeping his antennae open. And so she called me and said, "This is what's happened. My daughter's taken mifepristone RU46, and I've been told you can reverse it." And I said, "I can. Does your daughter want to reverse it?" So she said, "I don't know." So I got on the phone with her, and I talked to Cynthia. And after talking to her for a while, she said, "I finally talked her into coming in. At least, let's just do an ultrasound to see if the baby's alive." So she said, "Okay." So she and Jael came in to the office. We did an ultrasound. There was little Christian with his heart beating, bump, 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 bump. They both immediately started to cry right away. And her hesitancy was that she didn't know if she was still alive. So she agreed to the reversal. And thanks be to God, this is him. This is now a couple years ago. This was written up in World Magazine. And they've since gotten married. And at last year's Walk for Life in San Diego, they were there and gave their testimony. It was great to see them again. This is a text message from a very satisfied client. This is to Liz, who's my wife and one of the hotline nurses. "Hello, Liz. I just got home. Yes, I got the shot, and I'm going to return tomorrow also. I just wanted to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. You really saved me. I knew I had done wrong. It was by chance I got your number, and I am so glad I did. I feel relieved. You are my saving grace. God bless you, Liz." There are 28 exclamation points in that text message. So I think she's pretty satisfied. Summer and Jason sent us an email about their experience, and they allowed us to share this. And we asked them, "How has your life changed spiritually after APR? When we were given a second chance to save our baby's life, we knew God heard us crying out for mercy. We realize now that he had his hand woven through our story all along. The timing of the reversal pill and the people a part of it was truly incredible. What was my experience like at the abortion clinic? At the Planned Parenthood clinic, I was treated very coldly, to say the least, like a cow in a chute waiting to be branded. The dirty deed waiting to be committed, and then on to the next like it was no big deal. Insensitive to the fact that I was about ready to make the worst, most life-altering decision I would forever regret and haunt me for the rest of my days. Now I ask you, does Planned Parenthood really care about women if they treat them like cows in a chute waiting to be branded? What would be my advice to women," she says, "if I could sit down and talk face to face with each and every lady out there contemplating or whether or not to abort her baby, I'd say one thing quite frankly, choose life." That right there was Becky Buell, who was here in town for the March for Life, and she spoke at one of the other conferences that I think it occurred on the morning of the march yesterday. So she's become a super-duper APR advocate, and people hearing it from her or from anyone else who's gone through this, it just has such a profound impact. All of these conversion stories do, as you know, and she's been a particularly effective speaker, and we've been really, really blessed to have her helping us in our cause. The other woman that you saw in that very first video that we didn't continue, she had her baby and has now moved to Texas and is either married or getting married. So a really great success story there, too.
"That I was pregnant yet again on February 13th, 2013. I will never forget that day. I sat there alone, shocked and scared, staring at a positive pregnancy test, thinking this cannot be happening again. I had just proved to my entire family and everyone else that I was not just another statistic. I was headed down a promising path, attending college and caring for my son, all at just 18 years old. To make matters more complicated, we were living in my parents' home, and I knew that the rule was, if I were to get pregnant again, we were going to be forced to leave. Torn between the life of my unborn child and my 11-month-old, I decided that I was going to have an abortion, as I believed it was the only way to not further disappoint anyone and to not further complicate my education. At just 5 weeks pregnant with my second child, I sought out a chemical abortion. Yet little did I know God had other plans. You see, as I reflect back on those first few weeks, I see, without a doubt, that God set barriers, making it difficult for me to go through with the plan to terminate my pregnancy. Now let me explain what I mean by that. You see, the first abortion clinic I visited at just 5 weeks along was cold and brief, yet still I probably would have terminated my baby on that day had they not told me they didn't give the abortion pill on Fridays. Though this seemed odd to me, I went ahead and made another appointment for the following week. However, a sudden family emergency left me unable to get there. The next week, I visited a Planned Parenthood clinic, but I've always had these terrible veins that doctors have never been able to draw blood from, and sure enough, I walked in, and the medical assistant was unable to draw my blood, so I was unable to take the abortion pill that day. I returned to that same clinic the following week at just 8 weeks pregnant. On March 13th, I sat down in a Planned Parenthood clinic and swallowed the RU486 abortion pill. I planned to finish the rest of the abortion at home the following evening as instructed. As soon as I got to my car, I felt intense regret, and all I could do was pray, telling God how sorry I was for doing such a thing. While still sitting outside of that clinic, I searched for some type of reversal on my phone, and it was then that I found abortionpillreversal.com, a site ran by a pro-life pregnancy center called COLFS, based out of San Diego. Their website advised anyone wanting to reverse the abortion pill to call, so knowing that I had nothing else to lose, I chose to do so. A nurse named Debbie answered my frantic call and explained to me that two pro-life doctors had recently released a treatment to reverse the abortion pill, one that consisted of several weeks of progesterone injections. I could not believe what this nurse was saying. My thought was just, could there really still be hope for a child I had just tried to abort? With the help of this nurse and my sister, who I had confided in, I was able to locate a doctor, and within 24 hours of taking the first abortion pill, I had already begun the progesterone treatment for its reversal. Just a little more. When Planned Parenthood called to see why I had not returned to my follow-up ultrasound, the one where they make sure the fetus, as they refer to them, had been successfully removed, I explained to them that I had changed my mind and was taking steps to reverse what I had initially intended to do. I was then told by the Planned Parenthood director that what I was doing was very risky, likely wouldn't work, and that my child could very well be deformed. You see, after taking the abortion pill in these clinics, these people are trained to tell you that there's no going back and that your unborn child has already died and you must finish the rest of the abortion. Thankfully, I was prepared to hear this and I did not listen. On October 20th of 2013, I gave birth to my second son, Zachariah. He was born beautiful and perfectly healthy. As for the home I thought would be forced to leave, well, it is still our home. And as for the education goals I thought would be impossible, those two are going strong, as I'm currently in my third year of college and now at a Christian university. I am so grateful for the way our story worked out, and I am proud to stand with the pro-life community that helped enable my son to survive the first stage of an abortion. With medical advancements like this, we are one step closer to ending this war on the unborn. I know what I just said to you probably sounds a little crazy, so I thought it would be best to show you what I've been talking about. It is my greatest joy to be able to introduce you to my son, Zachariah.
All right, I'm going to back up now to our other one.
I decided to get an abortion at 19 because I couldn't, or so I thought, financially support a baby. I didn't even want to. I wanted to live my way, and I didn't want to not party and not drink, and I just wasn't really going anywhere in life. So I took the first pill on a Friday night at Planned Parenthood, and I took it in front of the nurse, even though I knew I didn't want to take it. I thought it was my only choice, so I just took it anyways, and then I went home with a second pill, which I chose not to take. The first pill cuts off the baby's food supply, and the second pill causes a miscarriage. It was raining, and I had to drive home at 5 p.m. back-to-back traffic, so it was a long ride, and I had time to think about it, and I felt intense regret and remorse and pain for what I had done, and the rain reminded me of Jesus crying. I just felt intense regret and remorse, and I wanted to change it and reverse it. So once I got a hold of the San Juan Diego Center, they told me to come in immediately because the sooner that you take the progesterone, the higher the chance the baby has to live. I went in the next morning, Saturday at 7 a.m., and I was just nervous until then. I almost backed out and I almost didn't go, but Patsy, who's the woman there, she called me and reassured me and asked if I needed a ride. And I felt like that was God's way of telling me that you're doing the right thing and the reversal is where you need to go. I was looking at lists of names for months. I didn't find anything I liked, and then I came across Ezekiel and I felt God say this one. Ezekiel was born in July and he was born perfectly healthy, almost 10 pounds, no defects. It fits in perfectly, and it actually means God strengthens, which gave me hope at the time, because after going through the reversal, my baby needed strength.
Hi, buddy.
God has ignited a passion in me, and he has brought me into the world of midwifery and children and babies and childbirth, and I've decided to become a midwife or a doula. I feel like I'm where I'm supposed to be, and I never would have gotten here if I hadn't had Ezekiel. I don't see myself as being brave, but I see God be brave through me in situations that I could never be brave for by myself. I want other women to know that they're not the only ones who have gotten an abortion or who have thought about getting an abortion. And even though there's immense pain and regret that comes along with that decision, I want them to know that God has the power to heal that hurt.
And one more video clip.
Thank you, James. New at 6 tonight, a local doctor touting a new treatment that she says can reverse the abortion pill and save the life of the fetus.
CBS 19's Stefan Dingle spoke with a doctor and a pregnant woman who wanted to end her pregnancy and then reconsidered.
So it just seemed like if there was any inopportune time for me to get pregnant, this was it.
Okay. Can you lie back and pull this up for your feet?
Crystal West is a mother of six, and adding another child wasn't necessarily in her plans. So she decided to end the pregnancy using the so-called abortion pill. It's a two-step process, and after step one, she had second thoughts.
When it comes to the medical field, where there's a will, there's always a way. And so I had Google searched, you know, if there was any possible treatment for undoing what I'd already done. It was too late. I couldn't throw the pill up. I couldn't get it out of my system.
No matter where you come from politically on the issue, these women are in crisis and are struggling. Sometimes people will make a decision and then they walk out of the room and in the light of day go, wow, I didn't mean to do this.
Less than a couple of hours after taking the pill, Crystal began to regret her decision as she came across this website, abortionpillreversal.com, which has a hotline of available nurses that connected her with local doctor Karen Pohalis.
We were able to see her and get the first progesterone shot into her about 25 hours after she had taken the pill, which was wonderful because the earlier you start, the better. It's very time sensitive. We have to fight the other medication.
So this is a vial of the progesterone that we use in this protocol. The mifepristone doesn't directly attack the baby. So if we can give enough progesterone to keep the drug from getting to the receptors, if we can keep the placenta alive, there have been no cases of birth defects in the babies who have been born using this regimen.
Crystal had to wait two long days praying to find out if the baby had a heartbeat.
You can do nothing but sit there and think about it. That's all you do is you think. And you wonder and you worry and you stress.
Finally, on that Monday, she received the ultrasound at UVA Medical Center.
Absolutely amazing.
You can't feel that?
No, I can't feel that.
I cried. I wasn't really thinking, you know. There's no thoughts about that. It's relief. It was the biggest flood of relief that I probably ever felt.
You're doing a great job.
Minus the throwing up,
you are doing a great job.
Yeah, we're going to make it.
And you're still smiling while throwing up. It's all good.
The chances of a baby surviving this procedure is 60-40. And Crystal says she's glad she took the risk.
Well, what if your baby has birth defects? It's possible, but my baby will be alive. You know, and that's a choice that I made. I don't feel like it was my place to decide whether or not the baby had a right to live.
Stefan Dingle, CBS 19 News.
This is a couple who were a part of our press conference at the National Press Club there with Father Frank Pavone and their little guy. So for those of you interested in supporting us financially, we're a nonprofit. It is tax deductible. You can visit abortionpillreversal.com or give us an email. It's a project, like I said, of Culture of Life Family Services in San Diego. And I want to leave you with the message that abortion pill reversal is safe, it's effective, and women do regret their choices to have abortions, and sometimes right away, and women do deserve a second chance at choice. I think we have a little bit of time for questions.
Good morning, sir. My name is Peter. I am a student at Concordia University in Nebraska. Thank you for your talk this morning. But I was wondering, more of a philosophical question for your profession. I've always had a question. Why are there so many doctors who are in favor of abortion ending the life of which we as Christians do believe begins at conception?
That's a wonderful question. And we do believe that life begins at conception. However, it's a medical and biological fact that life begins at conception, fertilization. So you don't have to just say it's because of your beliefs. It's a proven scientific fact. That doesn't make it any better than our faith beliefs. But remember that faith and reason don't contradict each other. They always go together. So the biologic fact is that it is a brand new human organism at the time of fertilization or conception. And just a quick comment on that. Because words are important and definitions are important, back in the 1970s, the medical establishment, especially the OBGYNs, changed what they called the definition of conception. Instead of meaning conception, what we've always understood it to be, when the sperm and the egg unite, they now say that conception is that implantation. So you can see that little rhetorical flim-flam gives them more of an opportunity to be abortifacient without calling it abortion. But we all know that it's a new human organism. When the sperm and the egg unite, we call it first a zygote, then it's an embryo, then it's a fetus. The question is, why does the healing profession that professes itself to cure disease and help people with suffering, why are they also the agents of killing? And I think it's because we've taken our eye off the ball, and we've, instead of considering ourselves stewards of the great gifts that we've been given of medicine, we've made ourselves into masters. When you make yourself a master, then you control when something begins and when something ends. And so we have in vitro fertilization controlling when things begin. You have abortion, you have euthanasia controlling when things end. And so it's a great hubris, it's a great arrogance that unfortunately the medical profession is falling into. It's happened before. In Nazi Germany, the Holocaust would not have occurred without the compliance and the agreement of the medical profession. That was one of the first things that the Nazi regime did, is to get the medical profession on board. First, they got them on board with euthanasia in the mental hospitals, and then they transferred all they had learned there to the death camps, and it was all directed by physicians and medical people. So unfortunately, the healing profession has become a killing profession. And what it's going to take is people with good, strong Christian beliefs who are pro-life to get into medicine and to change the culture there. And it's doable. We're changing the general culture. We will be able to change the medical culture, but it's going to take time.
Okay, Dean Wentley, I'm with the Concordia University system, and this is kind of a follow-up. How can we advance into the medical culture in a meaningful way? I studied with Stanley Hauerwas, who's a fairly prominent ethicist, and he said he was invited to various medical schools, and he was appalled at how little ethics are taught. And in that vacuum, is it simply a kind of a commercial motivation? Is it the dollar that drives these doctors to act? Because you would think, you know, with Hippocrates, that natural law would have some force restricting them from killing, even if they were non-Christians. You know, ancient Assyrians viewed abortion as wrong, and Africans without the Bible viewed it as a terrible evil. So I just puzzle over the darkness that evidently prevails at Harvard, Yale, and, you know, the chief medical places. Any kind of hope that we can penetrate that kind of darkness?
There is always hope, you know, because the victory has always already been won right here. So we always have to have great hope. The way to do it is to be clever, never abandon our principles, but don't search out fights that are not winnable. The fights will come to us. The persecution will come to us. There's no doubt about that. Dr. Harrison can certainly attest to that. But you don't go out looking for fights, and you look for allies. There are allies. There are quiet allies in these medical institutions, even in the darkest ones, even in the most secular ones. So what I do is I work with organizations that seek out pro-life clubs. I did a Skype presentation on abortion pill reversal to State University of New York in Stony Brook, to their medical school, and their pro-life club person who was setting it up, she was persecuted, and they were really attacking her. She stood her ground, and we were able to give that presentation. I think we were able to touch a lot of people. So we just have to keep looking for contacts in these institutions, not back down. Always be very measured in what we say. Never exaggerate things. Always give the medical facts. If they're not Christian or if they're not religious Jews, then I always present the natural law argument, because that can be more persuasive to people who are not willing to listen to religious arguments.
I'm Lyman Stone, and I have two closely related questions. One is, have you made any effort? I would think that pro-choice people valuing the choice of the mother allegedly would also be interested in this, that, well, shouldn't Planned Parenthood keep the resources on hand to assist a mother who has a medical abortion and then decides, oh, no, I don't want that? Has there been any effort to induce abortion clinics to be trained in how to administer reversal? And closely related, do you worry that if they did become widely aware of reversibility, or if the public became widely aware, that it would induce, well, you know, I can get the abortion if I decide 10 hours later I don't like it, you know, I can go back?
Right. Very good questions. The first question is, we made some limited overtures, but these pro-choice people, like I suggested in my talk, are not pro-choice. They're pro-abortion. They really only care about one choice, and that's choosing abortion. Planned Parenthood is all about money, if you haven't realized that yet. They're all about making money through their abortions and then making extra money by selling fetal body parts. And that's all they care about. Their whole model of prescribing low-dose contraceptives is they know that women and girls are not going to take them at the right time every day, and there are going to be X amount of pregnancies per every woman who takes that every year, and they calculate that into their business model. Carol Everett, who's now a pro-life speaker, she used to own a chain of abortion clinics. She states that in her testimonials, that that's what they did. They have a business model. So they're not interested in being pro-choice. They're just interested in being pro-abortion and pro-money. So those overtures have not worked. And we've also actually, the pro-choice people have attacked us. And in fact, some of the biggest names in abortion medicine and research wrote an article specifically attacking us. That was the aim of their article published in one of their big journals called Contraception. So they really have no wish for us to be heard or for anybody to discuss this or for any women to know. They're just interested in propagating lies and in denying what we're doing. And that goes the same for the American College of OBGYNs. They came out with a statement denouncing us and saying that this is not worth pursuing without really looking at our evidence at all or even talking to us. The second part of that question is, I have thought about that. If we make this abortion pill reversal so available, well, are women going to make that decision more lightly and just go into it saying, oh, I know I have a fallback? That certainly is a pitfall, but that's one we're willing to take because, like I said before, we want to leave no one behind. We want everyone to know about this because I think the risk is greater of a woman not knowing she has the option to reverse and her changing her mind and not knowing she has help out there. So we want everyone to know about this. We think that awareness is the best thing.
I'm Benjamin Jansen. I'm a student at Concordia Chicago. My questions, I was thinking about if one of my college friends said went through with the process, and I said, hey, there's this reversal pill. I was thinking about the two follow-up questions. One would be, well, what does it cost? And then two, what is the time frame for high success rate after the pill's been taken? Is it a lower success rate after the second pill has been taken as well? So price and time frame.
Sure. So first of all, on the price, we have not had a single woman who's been turned away because she couldn't afford it. We've had local benefactors, pregnancy resource centers who paid for it for women who couldn't afford it. The doctors in our network have been very generous. We also have funds that we distribute nationally to centers that can't afford to subsidize women. But if you look at the price, it's going to cost anywhere from, depending on if you include the ultrasound exams and doctor's visits, anywhere from $200 to $1,500 per patient to save a life. Now, many times as women, some of these are covered by their medical insurance, including Medicaid, although they may not cover the progesterone itself. They'll cover the doctor's visits and the ultrasounds. So those are how the costs bear out. And the second part of the question was, did you have a second part?
Time frame.
Yes, thanks. So the time frame, we've had success up to 72 hours, and we have been telling people that we think the sooner the better. It makes sense that the sooner the better. When we look at our big population of people, we're actually not seeing a strong relationship between the time they get it and the success rate. So right now we're drilling down a little deeper and looking at the high success groups and looking at those to see, because my instincts tell me that the sooner is the better, but right now we don't have those scientific evidence.
When Dr. Delgado was first asked to speak, some people questioned why we were going to have kind of a doctor give us a boring conversation about the reversal of the pill. I think that the reality here, though, for you that are college students and those of you who are pastors and those of you who are in the parish, is that there is a growing opportunity as we move from surgical abortion to these medically induced abortions, where the sort of second thoughts and guilt and sharing this with people who women have these relationships. So we wanted all of you especially to know that there are options. There are things out there. We wanted you to hear from Dr. Delgado, be able to access his website, the doctors who are within that network, because there really is an opportunity to save lives even after that choice has been made. So we thank him for not only the presentation, but for the work that he's doing, and 300 babies already saved. And I bet if we have him back in a couple of years, those numbers will probably be well up into the thousands. So again, thank you for your work and for joining us today, Dr. Delgado.